Know this song?
Yeah. I mean, I think because I've heard it in commercials for so long.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But, what's up, everybody? Another episode of Orale Bull Heights. You know what it is. Coming at you from Espacio 1839 here in Bull Heights. Today is Friday, of course. I'm not doing a mobile recording. And it's the last show of 2018. So I'm excited to have my guest here. Please introduce yourself.
My name is James Rojas.
Hey, James. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Yeah, so I've known James a number of years. We got introduced by a mutual friend, Victoria Delgadillo. Shout out to her. During one of your Nacimiento walking tours. That was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, yeah.
Are you still doing those?
There's less Nacimientos now.
Less, it's true, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nacimiento's changing.
Okay, can you tell folks a little bit about what they were?
The TV scenes.
No, the tour.
The tours, what I do is I give tours of Latino built environment and the way the Latinos use public spaces and the front yards and how the built environment really shapes the community and how the community shapes it as a way of cultural preservation and, and survival and identity.
Yeah, that's pretty much why I wanted to have you on as a guest, not only because I saw on your Facebook post that you were going to be in town, because you're really traveling a lot. You're always going up into the Bay or like out there, you know, East Coast, not Midwest Coast, but the Midwest.
Yeah.
And you're doing a lot of these workshops that you're known for, which we'll get into. But yeah, you're an urban planner by trade, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So I have a lot of friends who are urban planners, and I have a sense of what it is, but sometimes I honestly don't know what an urban planner does.
Well, I'm a self-taught urban planner.
So what is it that an urban planner does?
Well, urban planners, we plan the cities and the future cities, land uses, housing, transportation, public spaces. Mm-hmm. You know, identities, structures, all the different infrastructure that goes along with the city. You know, what we need, water, housing, sewage, environmental, regulations, all that stuff.
How everything's going to be placed, how folks interact with it, traffic, pedestrians, to even how, animals, have to navigate around that space.
Yeah, and the whole idea is, I think what makes me a self-taught urban planner is because I've been building cities since I was a kid. Here in Boyle Heights.
All right. I was going to say maybe you were playing SimCity.
Yeah. I was building. My grandmother gave me a shoebox and stuff to play with, and she was in her house, and I've been building since then.
All right. So we're talking like Lincoln Logs, Legos.
I mean, not just like stuff around the house. Because one year I think they modernized their bungalow in Boyle Heights. they put in plastic furniture and siding and. And they gave me all the scraps to play with.
Nice, cool. I mean, no better way than learning as a kid, because you're not really following any structures or rules.
Yeah, and I think that's what I do today. And I think, I'm a very visual and spatial person, so doing that activity as a kid just taught me how to understand cities.
All right.
And I remember I was like 7, 8 years old, and I thinking, learning that, small buildings are replaced by big buildings.
Oh.
Wow, that's incredible.
It's like they mature into full-size skyscraper.
Yeah, yeah. And as a kid, that's like, wow, it was like I should get the Nobel Peace Prize figuring it out. But that's how cities are. But I think as most planners, though, they see cities from a very abstract perspective.
I bet. I mean, even because you have to look at blueprints and a lot of technical details.
Yeah, and all that stuff's great. And we learn that stuff, but the city is basically a visual and spatial language.
Mm-hmm.
That's how people experience it every day, and that's how they understand it, and that's how they communicate it.
It's mind-boggling once you start really thinking about it.
Yeah,
especially in like super condensed cities like New York.
Yeah,
it just blows my mind. I just trying to think of the logistics of everything that goes into making everyday life happen.
Yeah, just what's underground there.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, over there, I mean, the first times I went to the East Coast, I was like, why is there steam coming out of the sewers?
Yeah.
And then, like, I learned about, like, the steams and, like, the heaters.
Yeah.
And, like, even incidents where, like, neglect has led to, like, explosions.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's like so much going on. Again, anything can happen.
Yeah, but it's but one of those things, though, that it's like a doctor. You know, our human body is really, really complicated, too, right? But we don't need to know everything.
True.
You just need to know how to talk about it and, you know, explain it to our doctor, right? So, same as city planning.
It's like, this hurts over here on my butt.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, let's figure it out and narrow it down. Yeah.
But you wouldn't say what missile it is.
No, you wouldn't. Yeah. You would say this road right here, this building.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, let's jump right into it. I mean, we already got to start talking. So where did you grew up?
Okay, I was born 2 blocks from here at
White
Memorial Hospital.
Oh, wow. You're like one of those OGs.
Yeah. Back in 1959, old school. And I grew up in... I was lucky enough to grow up in Boyle Heights and East L.A.
Mm.
And
were you moving back and forth?
Well, we lived in Boyle Heights behind my grandma's house on 2nd and Lorena. And then... When I was 4 or 5, we moved to East LA.
Mm.
You know, by Garfield, Atlantic, and Whittier.
Okay.
So yeah, so I always grew up in these two different worlds, and I've always associated Boyle Heights with my grandparents and East LA with my parents.
Of course, and they're
very different landscapes.
Yeah, city.
Yeah, Richards County.
Yeah.
Boyle Heights is hilly. And East LA is flat.
It's true.
A lot of it's flat.
Oh man, so how was it growing up back then? Because we're talking about, let's see, like 50s going into the 60s and the 70s. So this would be when most folks would be, like, I guess, more diverse in terms of, like, who was living in the neighborhood.
Yeah, right? I think on Boyle Heights, there was still, like, a lot of old Russian women living in there. And it was kind of old school, you know, still really, you know, it was a streetcar and...
Oh, that's right. The one that went down First Street.
Yeah, yeah. And... Yeah, it was fun. I remember I had older aunts and uncles that were like high school.
Oh, right.
Take the streetcars to like Connerty or, you know, Silesia and stuff like that. And but yeah, it was a pretty cool time because I was a kid, and you know, and as Latinos, well, I grew up in like in the family compound. My grandma lived in front, and then we lived behind. But I was at my grandma's house almost every day, and so was everybody else. So you grew up in this kind of collective,
That's where all the action was happening.
Yeah, well, kind of a community. So I was exposed to that, you know. So that was really fun. And then we moved to Boyle Heights, East LA, when I was like 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, And that was a dead end street, Hendrix. And
okay, so the cul-de-sac.
Yeah, I lived there, and we just played for like the next 10 years on the street.
Isn't that the best?
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of youth these days don't get that kind of experience. I mean, obviously things change every generation, but I was still part of that generation where like you can grow outside. Even though you still have to be careful and, you know, be mindful of things like traffic and dangers, but you can still be out there playing a basketball game, a football game, things like that.
Yeah, well, it was great living in East LA because it was a dead end street and it was flat, so there was always a lot of kids on the block, so we were always just playing outside. And it was, you know, it really kind of set my whole urban planning perspective, just from being on the street and kind of understanding people and architecture and buildings and who hung out where, you know, like the kids, the young girls hung out on the porches, the boys hung out on the streets.
Usually playing a game.
Yeah, the teenager guys had their lowriders. So you had all of like...
Were these just like the... At that time, it would have been the cars that people were turning into lowriders now.
Yeah, it was the car clubs. You know, that was a big thing. You know, because at that time, in L.A., gas was cheap. There was plenty of free parking and no traffic.
So
every Latino kid that was 16 bought a car. Every Chicano kid bought a car, right?
That seems like such a like a faraway concept to me because I've never known that.
Yeah,
it's always been congested and like traffic everywhere.
Yeah,
and gas.
And then the big thing at that time was, could they all put hydraulics in their cars? so they're always ripping off car batteries.
What?
You know, from cars.
Oh, wait.
Because those hydraulics need like 5 or 4 or 5 batteries.
Yeah.
So they would all drip them off from all the neighbors.
I mean, wouldn't it be kind of obvious who you could, like, narrow it down to, like, well, none of my other neighbors have a low rider.
Yeah.
So-and-so has a low rider.
Yeah, you know, probably pretty obvious, but, you know, it's kind of like, what can you do, right? teenage guys, you don't mess with them.
That reminds me of when stealing car radios was still a thing.
Yeah.
And that was like, oh, like the door.
That was the 80s.
Yeah, and you had to get the radio where, like, the faceplate come off, or, you pull it out.
Like a little purse to carry around with you. Yeah.
Kids these days won't know anything about that.
Yeah, that was LA, no.
It's like you gotta be mindful of just not leaving like your bag or purse or
your cell phone.
Or anything like a value like right there visible, because then like somebody will break the window and just get it.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Where did you end up going to school?
Well, I went to school, I went to Eastmont Elementary, then I went to St. Alphonsus for 8 years, then I went to Salesian and Shore High School. And then I went to East LA College, ELAC.
Yeah, go Huskies.
Yeah, did the whole ELAC thing.
Did you ever hear the people what they used to call it back in the day? They used to call it Taco Tech.
Taco Tech, really? Yeah.
I mean, when I heard it, somebody was explaining it to me is that the people used to say that as a put down. Gonna go to Taco Tech. You're gonna go learn to make tacos.
Yeah. That was the Mexicans kind of after my time, I guess. I was there like this was like the late, probably 70s. So it was still kind of different. Still pretty much a lot of Japanese, really a lot. It was very diverse.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, it's still reflective of the neighborhood with like so many.
Books. Yeah, but it was cool. You know, I liked it there. And then like you know, since I was gay. A lot of the gay guys would go there, too. A lot of Latino gays would go there.
Oh, all right.
So it was kind of a big scene.
Nice. Everybody just hanging out with
each other. Yeah. Because you're not in high school anymore. You're kind of in the mini big world. So that was pretty fun.
What were you studying at ELAC?
I don't know. I think architecture or something. Architecture and just, I don't know what to do with my life.
Okay, so you were just like trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
Figure might as well go be in school.
At that time I had no idea about college. I didn't even think about college.
Okay, how did you end up going like finding about ELAC and enrolling there?
Well, it was close, and you know, it was either like go work in a factory job or go there.
That's real.
Yeah, and it was one of those things that, you know, my dad worked in a factory down in Vernon, you know, and he had really bad hours, and he worked in Norris Industries where they were making bombs during the Vietnam War.
Oh, wow.
So he was working in the foundry plants, right? Where in the food, you had a big foundry there with all this, like,
meat
and stuff like that. And it was, like, grueling work. And it's like, I don't want that work.
It's like doing that for 30, 40 years and then retiring?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That's pretty tough. But I'll just go to ELAC for a year.
Why not?
You know, figure things out.
It's kind of like I got the same ultimatum. You go to school or you go to work.
Yeah.
There's no free rides here.
Yeah. So I just did that. And, you know, it was different back in those days. There was a lot of work in L.A., but a lot of manufacturing work like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of hard labor work.
Yeah. Then, hey, that was an entry point for a lot of folks to, you know, you grind it out, and then you're able to provide your family.
My dad, you know, two new houses, you know, cars, Catholic school, 4 kids. And, you know, I can't achieve that now.
I don't think
but he achieved it. You know,
unless
he achieved.
You're working for Google or something.
Yeah. If you're, you know, but so it's because like, there's a lot of resources out there, and a lot of possibilities. So that was good. You know, it was good. It was good years.
Yeah, were your parents born here? Were they born in some?
Yeah, my parents were born here. My dad was born in probably Bunker Hill, I guess. My mom was born in.
Before they moved it.
Yeah. He grew up there. Yeah, my grandma had this really wild story where, in fact, my dad grew up on Temple and Grant.
Oh, right in downtown.
Yeah. And my grandma worked at a coffee shop, a Bunker Hill that was run by a gay guy up there back in the 40s. So that's probably pretty crazy. But, so then he moved here, and then he was, grew up in Boyle Heights, and he was in first flats, and, you know, the whole gang thing. And it's funny because I see my uncles, all my uncles, my mom and dad's side of the family, all their teenage pictures are all in camp. That was like their graduation, going to camp, you know, juvenile hall or something.
Dang.
It wasn't the prom picture, it was kind of the camp.
No. Yeah. It's such a different time. I mean, if they were in that kind of life, were they like in the zoot suits, pachuco?
Well, there was pachucos. At that time, the zoot suits was already, that was like the 40s, but they were kind of more like more pachucos. But yeah, it's funny. I was thinking, yeah, you guys are all like in camp, you know?
Wow, that's a lot of history right there, man.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what kind of makes me, you know, because I think as Latino, you know, born in Ohio, East LA, you're born here. But you're also part of a narrative. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I think as like my parents and my grandparents, you know, they didn't teach me how to read and write, which is too bad, but they taught me stories.
Okay.
Yeah, so you inherit their life through their stories. So, you know, my dad, you know, my grandmother came in the 20s, my grandfather, they lived on Glass Street. And then she tells me stories about LA in the 20s, mm-hmm. you know, as a, you know, as a Latina, Mexican American, and you inherit her story about LA, and then my dad's story about all the gangs and Boyle Heights in the 50s, all the jazz clubs, and you know, all that stuff.
Central Avenue.
Yeah. But in the 50s, like East LA had a Boyle Heights. East LA had a big jazz. It was like West Hollywood.
Really?
Yeah. It was like it was you know, all down Whittier Boulevard to Atlantic, were just small jazz clubs.
Oh.
Because all these Latino performers are coming after performing in Hollywood or Beverly Hills, kind of east side and play.
Really? Oh, so it's like the after party.
Yeah, yeah. There were clubs like the M Club and all these clubs that ran all the way down to Atlantic.
Wow.
And there was a lot of jazz club here. But
you wouldn't know that from like going down Whittier Boulevard today.
Yeah, yeah. They're all gone, but it probably got wiped out in their 60s. But yeah, there was a lot of jazz clubs. Because I was talking to my uncle one day. He was saying, yeah, he went to Salesian. And you play the clarinet. You say, yeah, you know, I would get dropped off at midnight and play till 6 in the morning at some club.
Wow.
You know? Because they had these really crazy after-hour clubs
here. I bet. There's like all sorts of things going on in there.
Yeah. You would just go hang out there and hear music. It was all live music. Because there was no DJ. It was all live.
No. Oh, man. That's such a different time.
Yeah.
Such a completely different... Oh. See, so sometimes I think hearing stories like that make me think I was born in the wrong decade.
Well, but those stories become part of your narrative, right? Mm-hmm. It becomes part of who you are because you just hear them all the time. So, yeah, so it's kind of interesting because that's how I think about myself. You know, as I'll always be East Side because of those stories that you just inherit from your
grandparents. Yeah, but then, I mean, like those stories that, I mean, aside of you and keeping those stories alive from like your family. They're rarely heard outside in like bigger narratives.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not making like a Starz TV show about.
Oh yeah. That'd be a great TV show. You know, because it was interesting. Because one of my uncles was a Latin jazz singer, Eddie Gano, and I was reading his story. And a lot of Latino youth that back in the 40s, the 50s, they would go to school at Jefferson and take music classes there. Learn from the African American jazz players.
Okay.
They come back to the East Side and do their own music thing. Yeah. So it was like jazz music coming out of here.
Well, I mean, that's a great way to like to just learn because you have the opportunity to learn at school and then you bring it back.
Yeah.
And you put your own spin on it.
Yep.
Yeah.
So
now I'm gonna have to like look up some of this music.
Oh yeah, I think that'd be a great story to tell about, you know, this Latin jazz music that just happened, you know, in these neighborhoods.
Yeah, because it's rarely heard. And I mean, that's usually one of the things I like to do is just, you know, listen out to folks and hear what they have to say. Because sometimes you just hear the most random stories about like everyday life back then.
Yeah, so it was probably the equivalent to West Hollywood, the Sunset Strip.
Okay.
They were both unincorporated parts of LA County, West Hollywood and East LA. And you had all nonstop music.
Yeah, so much culture and like art going on at the same time. Yeah. And folks... I mean, you know, just tended to, like, have a need to congregate in social spaces.
Yeah, yeah. Latinos, you know, now they have mariachi before it was jazz.
That would have been different if it still had jazz.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So you went to Salesian, you went to ELAC. How long did you stay at ELAC for?
I was there for a year. And then I went to Woodbury to study design.
Okay.
I got into design and did that for 4 years. After that, I joined the Army.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, military. And that's when I fell. That's when I really kind of developed my love for cities. Mm-hmm. Put the frosting on it. Because I was living in Germany. And the first thing my mom does when she comes to Germany, she says, This feels like Orange County.
Whoa.
You know, it gets so organized, so orderly. And then I was there, we were there for 3 years in Heidelberg. And it was great because I would travel to, like, Paris, Amsterdam.
Were you in the Army?
Army, yeah. Okay. Listed, yeah. And I traveled. It was really fun. It was like a poor man's vacation.
You know, I've heard that before.
And it was cool because, you know, like, growing up in L.A., I would, East L.A., I'd never go to the West Side because those people just weren't my people. But
it's still like that.
Yeah, but in the Army, if you travel in Europe, you're in Paris or you're on the tour in Rome, and you meet people from L.A., from West L.A.
Wow.
In L.A., we would never, like, meet, but here we're meeting this in Paris.
You're from L.A., I'm from L.A., too. Yeah, what part of L.A.?
Yeah, yeah.
Did your military career, was that something by choice? Was it around,
It was by choice. I was kind of burned out by the party scene in L.A.
All right.
Yeah. Because you grew up and you're just like, I like to just party.
You need some structure.
Yeah, you need something different. You know, you kind of need to get away. And I wasn't going to go to college. You know, I wasn't going to, like, you know, go back east to college. So, you know, so I just decided, I went to college, but I wasn't going to go away. So I decided, I don't know how to get out, basically.
You just needed that change.
Yeah, yeah, change.
There wasn't a war going on at the time.
It was easy. It was great. It was because there was a Cold War, and it was all this military in the U.S., in Germany, and it was pretty
just having
expensive.
People stationed out there.
Yeah, and you could have long hair, and you could just kind of party there. And plus, a lot of the gay soldiers would be stationed in Germany.
Really?
Because there was more access to, you know, gay things out there than in Iowa or somewhere.
All right. Or Fort Worth, Texas. Navigating the system, yeah. Getting where they need to get.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a lot of fun. So it was fun, you know, and I had a good time. And it was, you know, just kind of broadened my horizons about cities and places. Because I'd been born and bred here in L.A.
And that, so you joined the military. You went to Germany the first time. What do you remember doing, like, those first few times you were visiting?
Where, in Germany?
Mm-hmm.
I'd go to, you know, just walk around and thinking, wow, what's this really walkable place here? You know, and just how everything is so small and so tight. And
this is, like, post-World War II, so, like, reconstruction and all that stuff already happened.
Yeah, it was still being rebuilt. It's like it is now, but, I was kind of getting back together.
Okay.
You know, and, there was a lot of burned-out places, but, it was interesting, you know, yeah, it's interesting because now, like, our military base in Germany, in Heidelberg, in Schwetzingen, was an old Hitler barracks. And it was, like, this really, like, big, severe, like, castle with this really steep roof on it.
Built to take a beating.
Yeah. Built to last 1,000 years. And then, I'm in this, it's called First Perscom, Tompkin Barracks. And it was the old Nazi, Hitler tank barracks. But now... And then it was off the Autobahn to get there. One of my friends just went back there, you know, from the same base. He said, the Germans took away the Autobahn next to the base now. They want to wipe out all the American, you know, that were ever there. You know, all these stories that, you know, American presence was ever there. But it was fun. I had a good time. Because I would travel a lot and take the trains. And that's where I really got into public transportation.
All right.
Because, you know, I take it in L.A., in East L.A., because in East L.A., I take the bus down Whittier to downtown. That was like our rite of passage was be able to take your bus, take the bus downtown by yourself.
Mm.
You do that when you're 12 years old, you know, my family. You know, but it was like, wow, but this whole city, all these cities in Europe are all about public transportation. So that's what I really got into, like, you know how this stuff all works. And then I was stationed in Italy for a year, in Vicenza. And that really is really, that kind of blew my mind because I was thinking, this place feels like East L.A.
Interesting.
The same kind of vibe. People out in the streets, everybody talking, everybody having a good time.
All right.
And that's where I started thinking about, you know, space and place and how these places, how people create their own identities and culture through the built environment. But so I was thinking, well, you know, but Italy is like 2,000 years old.
Yeah.
And they've designed a culture for their activities. So it's beautiful.
And it's always for walking.
Yeah,
like
walking.
Being a pedestrian.
Yeah, and being with other friends. Like they had the passeggiata at 4 o'clock, where the whole town just like, shoom, comes out there and just talks and hangs out. You know, and the plaza's there. And, I had an apartment there, an old building. My mom came to visit me there. She says, for a month, You got no telephone, you got no phone, you got no phone, you got no TV set. What do you do here? I mean, you just hang out, you know.
You hang out, you go get something to eat.
Yeah, so every night you're at the cafe hanging out.
You get a cappuccino, you get a cannoli, you see what's up.
Yeah, it's just like East LA. You're just like hanging out on the streets all the time.
See, that trips me out because, again, when I started going to the East Coast for the first time, I was genuinely excited just to get out of the neighborhood and like travel somewhere new for once. But, you know, kind of from like your perspective of like how, you know, people navigate their cities and how, you know, we interact with the built environment, I was excited because these are older cities. Much older than like Los Angeles or anything out here in the West Coast. So like being in New York and especially in Philadelphia, like I got a real sense of like, wow, like, you know, for such a long time, folks are just, you know, hanging out with each other, hanging out on stoops. Especially in the summer, you know, some like very communal and everything's not too, I mean, not compared to LA, a lot closer to walk to.
Yeah.
Or at least better public transportation in the sense that, you know, it's a lot more connected.
Yeah. Yeah. So for my big epiphany was comparing Italy or Vicenza to East LA. You know, so you have the same same Latin culture, but two different environments. Like, you know, Italy was for, they designed it for their culture. East LA, we inherit this kind of auto-focused, you know, American-built culture, and we change it. So the changes is what fascinated me with my research.
Okay.
You know, looking at, you know, how East LA, how Latinos change the environment to make it fit their needs.
Interesting. You know,
That's when I went to MIT.
From the military?
No, I was here for a couple of years in LA in the 80s. And I went to Cal Poly for a year.
Okay.
Pomona, and then I went to MIT. And that was my thing, like, you know, like, it was just this question, why did I feel so comfortable in Italy as a Latino and not in Germany? You know, and that was kind of the big question I had, and I started thinking about it at MIT and kind of started doing research at MIT looking at what makes East LA or Boyle Heights where I grew up a place I didn't want to be in. You know, what made it connect. You know,
okay. What's the magic sauce?
Yeah, the magic sauce. And, so I just came home for Christmas break for like 6 weeks and just took like 10 rolls of film of Boyle Heights and East LA.
Wow.
Just like all kind of stuff on the street.
You're just a shutterbug out there taking
pictures. I took pictures of the old donut store at, you know, First and Boyle and, you know, people's houses and, just like people guys fixing the cars in the street, you know, people washing clothes on the fence.
Even to this day, I still see you walking around with your camera.
Yeah.
So albeit a digital camera.
So I've been doing that since past 30 years.
Wow.
Just archiving, just kind of, you know, kind of exploring this Latino landscape.
And
in
do
the
you
US.
Still have some of those old photos?
Oh, yeah. But you see the same patterns, same everywhere. And, you know, going to MIT in the East Coast, you know, I had to reconstruct East LA, Boyle Heights at MIT.
How so?
Because if I had went to East LA or USC, I would have told my colleagues, well, just drive over there yourself.
Okay.
But over there in Boston, you couldn't do that, right?
Mm.
So I had to look at all these pictures and study and kind of put this whole story together.
Okay.
What's happening here. So it kind of gave me that critical eye to look at it in a different way.
To switch it up.
All right.
But how was it going to MIT when you first landed over there?
It was pretty tough. I mean, it's a tough school. And, you know, like I said, I'm a very visual, spatial person. So it was a lot of reading and I didn't really like. And, you know, I was kind of bummed out because...
That academic life.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, I love cities. I thought they were fun, you know, interesting. But you go to applying school, it's like all this, like, policy and technical stuff and all this, like... boring stuff. They take the fun out of city planning. They just see it as problems, you know.
It's like, we need a solution. How do you figure this
out?
Yeah,
how
do you do
it's
this?
All problem solving, but, you know, it's not the fun experience that, you know, we like, you know, in cities. So, yes, I started building. I had a huge model in MIT that I just built for 3 years. You know, my studio space there, because it's just a way to kind of relax.
Oh, yeah, that seems like very lethargic.
And it was also what I found interesting is that people at MIT are applying, they didn't think visual spatially. They just thought it was all about maps, numbers, and words.
Okay, so know. more like in the technical.
Yeah, yeah, and it was not about the qualitative experience. You know, so when my thesis on Latino urbanism, it was about my personal experience in East LA, and that's not kind of the typical urban planning study.
Yeah, no, I mean that's really going against the grain because kind of like we were talking before we started recording that, you know, it just seems when you think about urban planning. It kind of seems like a foreign concept because I immediately start gravitating toward the idea of like planning with like blueprints and like really specific technical details how, you know, how one new concept or idea will mesh in with like already what's there.
Yeah, it's kind of an outgrowth of engineering and kind of, you know, that kind of profession. But, you know, so for me, it's telling a different story, telling the qualitative story. You know, and that's what I did. And luckily, my professor, my advisor, Lisa Petty, she had worked in Guyana and Latin America a lot in the 60s. So she was really into she was fascinated by East Side Latino culture.
Okay.
Because there's nothing out there about it, right? It's funny. You know, because I was in class one day, and the professor was talking about, you know, the good city and the bad city. I just thought, well, where does East LA fit in? Is that a good place or a bad place? You know, if you look at the numbers, it's probably a bad place. But if the experience is a great place.
How would the numbers make it like a bad place?
Well, it's probably like they look at, you know, maybe car ownership, income levels, crime. You know, so that paints a different story of a place.
All right.
You know, but so if you live here, it's a different experience.
The comparison between like the number of people who own their homes, the number of
all that stuff like that, homes. Which are, you know, just numbers. You know, that doesn't tell you a story about a place, though.
No, it doesn't. See. I'm kind of like glad you hit on that because that's been one of my biggest, like, I mean, in some of the advocacy work that I do in transportation,
that's
always frustrated me in terms of like the way like city planners from like the Department of Transportation or just from wherever they are in the city will come into a neighborhood and kind of like just what you said, they'll look at the data.
Yeah,
they'll look at this intersection has a high number of collision rates. Amount of problems, X amount of that. What tools do we have in our toolbox that could fix that problem, address it, or whatever?
Yeah.
And usually that's how things are. I mean, I'm assuming mostly because it's the city and the bureaucracy. That's how things are traditionally done.
Yeah, but there's more to that, and it's also about the story, narrative, the culture.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been really kind of advocating for is that, you know, how do you dig deeper, and how do you understand people's behavior patterns, their aspirations, their needs, their memories.
And really understanding a community.
And how that impacts that use of space. Because I was at a conference in New York, Vision Zero, and I was at an equity session.
Was this year, last year?
Yeah, this year. And it was horrible. It's always like consulting firms now doing equity by looking at numbers. I tell them, you know, you got to talk to these people. You just can't look at their car ownership, their income level.
Preach it, James. Preach it. Oh, yeah, man.
But it's a big money grab now.
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
And oh, man.
You know, so I was thinking, no, equity you have to talk to people about this equity issue. You know, you can't just make a matrix and say, we got it, you know.
Yeah, you can't just, you know, do what you do, which is like print out a big poster board and ask people to put a sticker where they think they like it or where they don't like
it. Or just look at numbers.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's. So for me, you know, writing my thesis about East LA Latinos was telling the kind of the qualitative story.
Okay.
What's that story about East LA? I wanted people to know about why it works and what's that, what's that story that keeps it together.
So did you get a lot of pushback when you were doing this? It seems like such a foreign concept for folks used to working with data.
Yeah, it was probably the only thesis like that in MIT. But it was. But people were fascinated by it because nothing else had ever been written about it that way.
Okay.
You know, so it was like, wow.
You were essentially pioneering and breaking new ground.
Oh, yeah. That's, because nothing, and it was.
And this was in the 80s.
Yeah, late 80s or 90s.
Wow. All this time, and folks are just be like, let's just keep doing what we're doing. Question it, think outside the box.
Yeah. But people weren't pushing that structure because I think, you know, the applying profession. Basically, you know, what I've learned is that being in it for 30 years or, probably that long. Is
a
that,
good chunk of time, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of it is based on middle-class value to perfection.
Okay.
You know, because like a lot of the planners, they grow up in middle-class suburbs where everything's perfect.
The grass is symmetrical.
Perfect. Yeah, it's perfect. And they understand perfect. They understand perfection and what's right and what's wrong.
It's like cookie cutter housing and all that.
So if you're like me, growing up in East LA with very DIY, there is no perfection.
Nope.
That's how you survive. You know, it's no perfection.
You know, and you might have a bungalow next to like a Victorian home.
Yeah. For me, that's how I understand city planning. But that is a foreign concept to urban planners.
Yeah, because that really like plays up to more to your lived experience.
Because they want to see everything in perfect order, right?
And that's how they grew up with it. That's how they see it.
Yeah.
And they go into school and replicate.
Yeah, and that's how the whole planning profession is set up.
Mm.
You know, so even if you get more Latino planners into the profession, they're still buying into that ethos about perfection.
Because they're learning from them.
Yeah. That's how it gets handed down. So it's kind of changing for me. It's changing the whole way we understand community building.
Okay. See, with you explaining that now, I fully understand why when I was mentioning to you earlier that when folks were first introducing me to you and your work, a lot of folks will just like off the bat say, James, you don't know James Ruiz? He wrote the book on Latino urban planning. So, I can truly see that now. It's like, wow.
Yeah. And basically what I did, I looked at, you know, Latinos. I took all these pictures. They had all of like physical, visual, spatial information.
Very non-traditional,
right?
Of what folks are doing.
Yeah. I didn't count numbers. I didn't count people. I didn't do anything like that. I just looked at the stuff and how I connected with it. I wrote about it. So basically, in a nutshell, Latino East LA is about social cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. So therefore, how do we build around social cohesion? You know, so what happens, you know, Latino buys a house in Boyle Heights, East LA, they got a front yard, they turn into a plaza.
Okay.
Because they miss a plaza from their hometown in Mexico where they all gathered at, and that was like their heart and soul, right?
A communal gathering.
Yeah,
space.
So they put that in the front yard. They put the fountain there, they put the benches, they put even the lights sometimes. Oh, landscaping. So it kind of reminds them of home. So you have these plazas in these front yards people hang out in. They build fences around their houses, their front yards. They talk over the fence. Like my mother in East LA, she would talk over the neighbors. After the dinner, she talked to the neighbors all the time over the fence.
Yeah.
One or the other.
Yeah.
So that's you're building a social network. And that's really critical for Latinos, well, you know, from my experience. And that's what planners do not do.
Nope.
Because if you look at a map and dots, that's all about design and middle class values.
Yeah.
We're going to make this place more perfect.
Yeah.
There's no narrative, no story there.
No, it's all stale.
Yeah, so I start with the story. I want to know your story. I want to know who you are, what your story is, and why you're here.
How you grew up, how you interacted with the space.
Yeah. I don't want to know about the design. Because most people of color, Latinos, we're worried about our family, friends, and neighbors.
Yeah.
That's front and center, right? We don't really care about the design of the streets.
We'll
make our own design. But I think most parents come from that middle-class background where urban design, that's the valued design.
Like,
so
how would you use this road?
Yeah, or where do you put the tree at? Where do you put this at? You know, that kind of stuff. But so that's a very... It's a very different way of approaching community.
Yeah, it
you know,
is.
You know, it's just about social connection, social cohesion, or the design, or the physical base. You know, so Latinos, you know, a lot of our DIY landscapes are very much about the cohesion and how that manipulates the built environment. Like my friend was doing this thesis at MIT on new urbanism.
Okay.
You know, the new way of looking at building, you know, smaller walkable communities. And, you know, he was, the architect was dictating, you need to have small lots, you need to have front porches and fences to make it more pedestrian friendly. The exact same things that Latinos are building, you know, on their own, is that the architects were prescribing in new urbanism.
Yes. It's almost like they're copying their notes.
Yeah. So it's the same, the same end product, but different ways of getting there.
You know, I think I've heard the same with, I guess what the trend is now, supposedly, according to my like urban planning savvy friends, is like tactical urbanism.
Oh yeah, tactical. Yeah. But that's again another. Latinos have been doing that for years.
Yeah.
You know, but we don't blog about it. We don't talk about it.
Not in those spaces.
Yeah.
Not like that.
And it's also, I mean, a friend just wrote a book about the Help Yourself City, Gordon Douglas and San Jose State. He interviewed like 30 people that do tech urbanism. It's all mainly white men.
White, pale, and stale.
Because they see a problem, they got to fix it. And then they got to brag about it.
Oh, man.
You know, for me, like, I just examine the community, what Latinos do. You know, nobody takes ownership of it. It's just all there.
Yeah, it's very communal.
And there, everybody has a place in that landscape. You know, La Senora selling champurrado, you know, a little kid playing the street, with all the guy working on his car.
Yeah, a little dog chasing you around.
It's all part of that whole picture, right?
Yeah.
Nobody's claiming it. Oh, I did this, you know. Mm-hmm. I made this, I built this. It's all very matter of fact, and it's what you do. So it's not about the hope, it's not about the glory, you know.
Yeah. All right, so you're MIT over here rewriting the book. When did you finish?
Well, I finished the thesis back in 91. And then after that, I was really excited. I wanted to come back to LA and change things up.
Come back to the sunny weather.
Yeah, so like I mailed my thesis out to all these people, and nobody cared.
were you mailing it to like get it read, get it published?
Well, everything, you know, like okay. to get this published, and I might mail it to some of the leaders there, and nothing, you know, it was like flat.
Would you think it was because of what, like the same similar pushback you were getting when you were in school, that folks just weren't understanding this?
Well, I wasn't understanding it, and I think it was also people weren't ready for it.
Oh, in the 90s, people weren't ready for this.
Yeah, they were just like, you know, everything's good the way it is. You know,
why change it up?
Yeah, why change it up?
If it's not broken, don't fix it.
Yeah, yeah. But I think what happened for me, the big change was the LA riots.
Oh, 92.
Yeah, because that's when that Gary thing, like people were thinking, well, there is something going on here. We need to start to think about these different communities and different ways of kind of, you know, engaging them and kind of understanding these different lifestyles. So that's where that really kind of like, you know, pushed my research to be a lot more
interesting,
more popular.
That's kind of like one of those points where it kind of woke everybody up.
Yeah, yeah. And then like I remember Mike Davis read it and said, "This is the fifth ecology of LA." Latino ecology.
Yeah. All right. So you're here back in LA. You're out there, you know, hustling, getting that thesis out there. It's, what were you working on since you came back?
Well, when I came back to LA, I had a job in Santa Monica, working at the planner there. You know, just like just starting. You know, I think I was counting bar seats at restaurants near schools or something. Mm. Very plannerish, you know.
Okay,
so that's wrong. Just, that's right. You know,
you were back on the grind, making that money.
Yeah. And then I was living in West Hollywood, in Fairfax, and Melrose. Yeah, it was good. Life was good. But then everything changed up with the civil unrest, you know, and the whole thing just, like, burned. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was, like, we were watching on TV, and, you know, it was, like, 2-3 days, just, like, everything just kind of created falling
were
apart.
Were you at home watching as
it was? No, at work, you know, Santa Monica. Okay. And let us out of work early. It took like, 3 hours to get from, like, Santa Monica to Fairfax.
Dang.
It was, like, the whole people, everybody was just leaving the city.
It's like, all right.
Yeah, we're out of here.
Time to blow this popsicle stand.
Yeah. So it was really crazy, and all these fires were everywhere. And so I just thought, well, you know, how do we as planners become better people and understand, you know, how to do better, understand the city a lot, you know, and just, you know, because I think that riot was more a reflection of bad planning.
Okay.
People weren't happy. They weren't getting what they wanted, so they just
took it. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of, like, socioeconomic things leading up to that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people getting killed, a lot of violence, a lot of racism from the LAPD, tensions within the community.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you were talking about your parents. I mean, at least your dad, you know, growing up and working in those factories, and now all those jobs where a lot of folks, especially in South LA, were gone.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So there's really a lot of issues out there that people weren't really looking at or understanding. So, yeah, so just really... So after that, I joined the Peace Corps.
All right. So tell me a little bit about that. What is the Peace Corps?
Well, so I joined the Peace Corps in 92, 93.
What is it, though?
It's a government-sponsored agency set up by Kennedy to send Americans overseas to understand cultures and help them.
All right.
You know, and like the army with the occupier, peace with the officer.
We're here in peace.
Yeah. We want to know you. So I went over to Eastern Europe, to Budapest, because at that time the government was...
Back to Europe.
Yeah, well, the government was trying to, like, really promote the civil society in Eastern Europe because it had been communist for so long that they just had, like, the one-party system. They wanted to promote civil society, so I was working there doing environmental transportation work, you know, doing, like, sustainable transportation. All these concepts I never heard about in the States.
Wow.
It was talking about that. That was kind of happening in Europe.
You know, it's always interesting that for everything that's happened, like, after World War II, with, like, Japan getting rebuilt, a lot of Europe, a lot of Germany getting rebuilt, it seems to me that, like, when the U.S., you know, when everything was said and done and settled and, like, the plans were set to move forward, you know, the U.S. kind of went in there and told Japan and Germany, like, you're going to rebuild this way and do all these things and kind of make things better. But it always kind of, like, struck me that they helped them so much, and that nothing really changed here in the U.S. Like, things just kind of ended up getting worse.
Yeah. And I think, but at least in Europe, though, that was communist, and that was really funky because the clock hadn't moved from 1945.
Oh, wow.
People were just old school trams. You know, it was like, wow, this is like...
In the 90s.
Yeah, it was like, well, this is like L.A. back in the 40s. You know, the streetcar and trams and... People are still raising pigs and killing them, and, you know.
See, that's now farm to fresh.
Yeah,
that's organic.
you know, picking grapes, all these kind of things. And, yeah, everybody had wine cellars. So it was really cool because you kind of really looked at a whole different urban infrastructure.
Yeah.
No, it's kind of, you know, it was like pre-car, you know. We had cars, so...
At best, maybe you had, like, a carriage.
Yeah.
A donkey or something.
Yeah, but it was really, like, old school. So it was fun, you know. It was like, you know, because you went to a town and the village, you went to the market, and there would be, like, 5 cans of pickled cucumbers. A sack of flour, you know, everything had to be homemade.
Man.
Yeah, so it was pretty fun.
That sounds like it was delicious.
Yeah, it was good.
All right, so Peace Corps.
And they came back to L.A. and worked at... I got back at Metro. I worked at Metro before I left L.A. really quickly.
Okay.
And then I remember it was funny because my Metro project was... laying out the Green Line project, the airport now, it's getting built.
Like 30 years later.
Yeah. I worked at that. You know, it's gonna be lined down Aviation Street, right? And
was that the original plan to have the Green Line do that, right?
Now they're doing it. Yeah, it kind of got...
But something happened back then where, like, maybe there wasn't enough money?
Well, it's not enough money and not enough support. I think the mayor was trying to push all the taxi drivers. They make like $90 million in taxi services out there, eating a lot of money.
Is this Tom Bradley?
Maybe or somebody. No, I think it was after him. Ridden or somebody.
It was Ridden,
I think.
I can't really remember. My LA neighbor.
But it was, I think, Ridden wanted, you know, he didn't want the rail at all.
Oh,
so.
That's right. Ridden.
Yeah, because they would never work in LA.
No.
So I came back to L.A. all charged up about, you know, being in Eastern Europe and writing all these rail systems and transportation plans and really experienced a different kind of urbanism.
Yeah, man, living your best life.
And they worked at Metro. I started working on the East Side.
East Side Access Project.
Gold Line.
Yeah,
all
right.
That project, yeah. Well, because what happened, they clobbered the Red Line extension. But Metro had bought all the property around Marachi Plaza and First and Cesar Chavez and Soto.
Yeah. Some of those are still empty to this
day. Yeah, it was still empty. But then Gloria Molina brought back the East Side Gold Line, you know, the light rail line. And it wasn't heavy rail, so it was legal to build it.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because they had really stopped all heavy rail in L.A. for a while.
The last one was a red line.
Yeah. Now they're doing it again, but yeah, it was like... So I worked on that project. That was pretty cool because I came back to East LA working here as a planner and just seeing how how things were rolling out and how bureaucracies think about communities and stuff like that. And
was this in the early stages or anything?
Early stages, yeah. Okay. You know, working with barrio planners and a lot of people here in East LA and Boyle Heights that are still around. You know, so yeah, it was good. It was that kind of a good intro back to the East Side. You know, now I could apply my work. You know, 10 years later to the actual project. You know, and that's legitimate. In fact, we did a really cool video. I took this video company around Boyle Heights, East LA, to do a video on how on your community. You know, and just kind of put it, just like, you know, the vendors and the, you know, and the houses and how it's all shaped and how transportation can change to enhance these kind of lifestyles.
Interesting.
It was a good video. I mean, it was really fun because it was kind of looking at the lifestyle first and then kind of how you put the transportation to really feed into your lifestyle.
What's already there. Basically what you wrote your thesis.
Yeah. So it was good. You know, but I was working there for a couple of years and yeah, it was, you know, Metro, there's a lot of, it's a bureaucracy, and
of course,
and a lot of it is also, people have their kind of idea of what they want, and they really kind of like,
very much like you were saying earlier, with how people go into urban planning,
how they want to shape, they want to shape certain outcomes, you know, so it was a video that kind of eye opener for me, because in Eastern Europe it was really different, you know, B2B to NGO. So one of my things was that we'd have meetings with East LA with all these Latinos, and they wouldn't say a word. You have 40 of them in a room, right? They're just looking at you and I'm thinking, I know you guys have ideas. I've seen your front yards. I know you could do something.
All of a sudden, everybody's shy.
Yeah. So, but at the same time, I opened up an art gallery in downtown LA on Spring Street.
G27?
Yeah.
Adrian?
Yeah. I think you were probably.
I was very lucky enough. To be, you know, this was in the early days of when the art walk was popping off.
So I opened up an art gallery. And I was really fascinated by all these, like, you know, artists like Santa Delosa, Carmen de Guerta.
A lot of folks doing a lot of work. Yeah.
But how they can engage audiences with their artwork in really creative, productive ways, but we as planners can't. So I thought, you know, how can we as planners be more like artists and engage community to break in different ways that are visual, spatial, and creative. So we're not just telling people, we're kind of making creativity happen.
That's like oil and water trying to mix.
Yeah. So, but the gallery space was a good place to really, you know, start my practice.
Go look, have those conversations.
Yeah, and really develop my method of, you know what I do now. So it was really, you know, it was really, really important to have that kind of outlet. And
of course.
Yeah, but it was a lot of fun. You know, I learned a lot. You know, having the gallery space and building models there, and people still remember those models. So, yeah, you're the guy that built the models and that gallery up on that mezzanine floor up there. You know, but that was a good way for me to really kind of really change the planning process to make it a lot more visual and spatial. Because you're working with all these artists that are visual and spatial, mm-hmm, and kind of bringing planning to. Making plan that part of that world.
I think I remember Carmen at one point.
The carpet.
Yeah. But then, like, more recently, not so recently, she did an installation where it was like a walkthrough of one of her childhood homes.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is like the fucking home I grew up in, with like the trimming on the walls and the doorways and the built-in chimney and kind of like china cabinet looking thing with drawers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, what was good about it is that I was an urban planner and these were all artists.
Yeah.
And these artists had never thought about their work from a planning lens.
Oh.
So we'd have a really good discussion. In fact, I remember with Carmen, we had a lot of discussions about her work because, you know, it was like, you know, I told her about my work, you know, urbanism, you know, my research, my thesis, and she could not have written that thesis as a woman. Because she grew up in Pico Union, it was dangerous in the 90s.
Oh, that's right.
She couldn't go outside.
Yeah, you got 18th Street.
Yeah. So that carpet was her whole life. So that kind of formed her, you know, her identity with that carpet space. You know, the living room, dining room, kitchen.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, as Latino, as a male, as a kid, you're just taught to be outside.
It's such a gendered experience.
It's a different experience. Like, you know, we're taught to look at people, talk to people, where a little girl is like, no. Don't make eye contact. Don't talk to people. So it was interesting, you know, talking to her and hearing about, you know, her perspective. Because I just thought, well, you know, like, everybody thinks like me, you know, everybody. But they don't.
It's easy to fall into that. I get you on that one.
Well,
I also want to talk about this, too, is one of the other projects you had when you were working at Metro was the Evergreen Jogging Path. So, tell folks a little bit about that.
Yeah, because Evergreen Jogging... Well, in Boyle Heights, there's not a lot of parks here that are recreational.
As I've learned, we're park poor.
So people kind of do DIY basketball courts in their streets and play in the streets, and they jog around. But we have a lot of cemeteries. And these cemeteries are... You know, the perimeters don't have any driveways. It's a miracle in L.A. to have a mile and a half and only one driveway. One curb cut, right? So people in Boyle Heights were jogging around the cemetery. And
So people were already using it
kind of informally. It was concrete. And in fact, a lot of the people that I met, you know, when I was doing the East Side Goal Line project were the same people that are... We got to talk to them and talked about, you know, how do we fix up this... They were asking, how do we fix up this... broken up a sidewalk, you know, around the perimeter of Evergreen Cemetery. So we thought, well, that's a good idea. So I thought, you know, my thesis, well, use the space and how we change that as Latinos to make it a jogging path. So that was kind of the theory behind it, and then kind of going after the money. And then I had, at that time, I had a group called Latino Urban Forum.
You still have the website?
I don't know if you still do, but it was a group of like Latinos like myself that were born and bred on the East Side or Latino, and were working for government jobs.
Latino Urban Forum.
They were working for like the City of LA, the Public Works Department. So you had this whole inside network of how to work the bureaucracy.
Oh,
and how to get the money?
Yeah,
we're working with. That's when Nick Pacheco was a councilman. And a lot of councilmen. I mean, they're good people, but they don't really know the details.
No, they're worried about the FBI these days.
So having this like group of like, you know, like 20 Latinos that work in all the different departments, they can identify where the money could come from.
These little Avengers of city and urban planning.
But we're all friends. We're all Latino. We're all on the same page, so we can identify. How to get the thing built? Where do you find the money? We could say we want this. I want everything, but if you don't have a plan to get implementation plan, it's not going to happen.
How are you going
to
realize that dream?
So having this network of Latinos, you know, worked in City Hall and local governments, agencies, we were able to identify, I think, $800,000. This is like a lot of money, you know, to build it, you know, get it.
It's a mile and a half,
to get it funded, put the rubberized track in there. You know, we just wanted to fix the sidewalk because the parkway and the sidewalk were like 3 inches, 4 inches, you know,
uneven,
worn away,
dangerous, especially if you're running.
But the city said, well, we can do this whole rubberized track. So my friend Lupe Vela worked at Public Works. She identified some funding, you know, identified the funding there. So we put together a package and gave it to Nick Pacheco and say, here's your package here.
It's like, you don't have to do anything.
You just sign off of it
and get us the money.
You take the credit for it. Yeah, yeah. Because I think that was a lot of the work I did back in those days was really helping communities kind of from the insider, you know, working at Metro and working and understanding how he's
navigating that system.
And just saying how we can make it work for us.
Cool. All right. So quick question for you on that tip. Your whole experience, especially being in Metro, like you were saying, that you were, you know, working within the institution, navigating it, using those resources and that power to bring in changes, or at least positive changes to the community here in Boyle Heights. Did you ever get any pushback? Maybe that you were like a sellout for working with the government, or like, you know, that you were like a traitor because you were working. And I bring this up because this is my experience where people say for like almost... very much doing the same what you're doing, they call me a vendido.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
For me, you know, I'm like second generation Boyle East LA, right? Mm-hmm. So, I think, you know, as Latinos, you know, we want to improve our quality of life.
Yeah.
We want to improve our
built environment. You want to do better than your parents, yeah.
Yeah, you know, we're building our front yard fences, our front yard plazas, our... you know, our nacimientos, we're all about the built environment. And for me, it's like, how do we enhance the built environment? You know, and how do we make it better for everybody? And, you know, and there's certain ways of doing it, right? You know, like, you could build a front yard fence, it's really beautiful, but how do we build a jogging path? Like, yeah. $800 million, you know, $800,000, whatever that might
be. A huge project.
$1 million, right? You know, so, but you have to know how to get that money, make that thing happen. So I think a lot of it is really, you know, understanding, you know, how do we enhance the built environment at different levels. You know, there's room for everybody here.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think so we need that. You need that expertise. You need to know how to write a grant.
Yeah. People think it's so easy, but it's not.
Yeah.
And especially in the nonprofit world,
a lot of that
grant writing is not so much about being able to write it; it's just who you know and how you can network.
Yeah, how you network and what kind of story you tell. Like for the jogging path, we had Michael Walker do the artwork. He did a Calavera jogging run in peace.
And it was probably
the only project I ever worked on where everybody was really happy about it.
I love his work. Michael Wark is a great artist.
Yeah. So he did it for us. But yeah, so I think a lot of it is, you know, how do we go and take it to the next level? Do projects like that, you know. And I think and like I say, the system, it's not working, doesn't work. But you know, we have to change it with you know ourselves, and we have to work in that system.
Yeah, because otherwise they're just gonna keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, they're on their merry way, like, oh, nobody's complaining. All right, we must be doing something, right?
Yeah. Well, people just it's culture and not complaining, so we would just take it, you know.
Well, a part of that too is, you know, because folks rent, sometimes there's no real sense of ownership.
Oh yeah, but I think the mechanisms that we use are the wrong ones. We use perfection and order as the end goal. We don't use social cohesion.
Ah.
If you use social cohesion as your planning strategy, you're not going to get displaced because now you're thinking about how people come together. Otherwise, people say, well, it's just market forces.
Yeah.
You're out of luck. You know? Should have bought your house a long time ago.
You should have bought a house.
Yeah.
You know how not to get
but you put a different value on things.
Yeah. Oh man. All right. So, you were at Metro. You did a couple of things. So what came after that?
Yeah. So the jogging path wasn't a Metro project. It was a community project.
Okay, my bad. Yeah. So it was for some reason I had that.
Well,
in my
I worked
mind
at Metro, but it was kind of my
that was my association.
It was my night project. What I tell a lot of Latinos that work in government is that, you know, do nonprofit work at night, or do advocacy work at night, because you're going to be bored.
So day job was Metro. Your side Latino, hustle was out here like building a jogging path.
Yeah. So then you have all the networks for your day job that you can tap into for your night job.
Wow, that's so cool. I didn't know that. For all this time, I was like, yeah, Metro. Metro did all of that. Metro did.
Now they're doing it, but it would have been because at that time in LA, it was all about equality. So the pie gets split 15 ways, the same piece. You know, everybody gets the same piece.
Even the folks that need it the most don't get the attention.
Yeah, because I was really into bus stops back then, and you know, everybody in Westside wants bus stops, but we have ridership on the east side. But every councilman only gets 15 bus stops for the whole district. Neither don't need it.
That's not enough.
Yeah. So I would fund bus stops for the east side in Lancaster, Palmdale. Yeah.
Oh, man.
But that was fun. It was good because I had a lot of projects you see get built. But you know, it's a good way of kind of doing things.
So what was your next move after that?
After that, I left Metro and started doing my own thing.
Okay, so this is when you went on your own.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, either now or never, right? I'll be coming back to this.
What is this?
Sorry, bureaucrat, you know.
Early 2000s?
Yeah, probably 2010.
Okay.
Well, I started doing work, you know, 2000 I was doing work at the gallery at Latino Urban Forum. I quit at 2010. Sorry, saying, well, I need to, this will be my next step, and either I do it now or I never do it.
That's true.
And it's been really good. It's really been interesting kind of investigation on urban planning and you know, in Latino communities. And what's interesting is now, you know, I just did the workshops you know, the place at workshops, you know, with the objects, and that's what kind of sells. Latino urban stuff doesn't really sell. That's more of a theoretical, you know, like
that's thing. That's like talking more shop.
Yeah. People don't really think about it that much. You know, but it's really important, you know.
No, I mean, all these years and people still haven't caught on. But, you know, slowly but surely, there's like I said, I have a bunch of friends who are urban planners.
Yeah.
But I think most of them, if not all of them, are familiar with, like, you and your work. Because, you know, they're inspired by folks like you who trail this path of, like, doing this work.
Yeah.
And doing something positive with it in our community, not just, like, going out there learning it and all of a sudden becoming a young professional and owning a home and having kids and a white picket fence and all this other stuff.
Yeah, the other way the bean. But I think, what's interesting now is that, you know, I go to places like Grand Rapids, Michigan. Or I go to Brownsville, Texas. You see the same cultural patterns identified, you know, in East LA back in the early 90s all over the country now.
Wow.
So it's like this national, second national movement, you know, you see the same.
Because people happening. Are like slowly moving up to
all these places and bringing their traditions. They're bringing the culture with them, their traditions.
Interesting. That must trip you out.
Yeah. In fact, I would like to do like a Heuhlhauser, you know, Latino Goals piece. Where you go to all these small towns all over the country and find Latino urbanism there. For instance, Woodburn, Oregon. That's a center for Latinos because they all take care of the Christmas trees.
Interesting.
You can take a bus from East LA to Woodburn.
Man.
You know, lots of stay as a bus up there, right? And it's a little tiny town. It's all from Michoacan. It's all painted up. They have a plaza there. It's replicate Michoacan. You know, and it's just really little place that, you know, you could get, you know, Mexican food there, but it's really part of that whole connection, you know, space.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, but people don't talk about it, but you realize how pervasive it is. Like in Grand Rapids and Brownsville, Texas, that's part of the whole, you know, farm worker culture. People, because the whole Midwest is this big circle that, you know, Latinos go from farm to farm, you know, picking crops. That in L.A., that's not part of our culture at all. You know, so it's like a different identity. But
that's true.
It's still the same landscape, but you have different stories about how Latinos get there.
Yeah, very much somebody goes there first and then tells everybody the getting's good and like, hey, come on over.
Yeah, and then Chicago is like the second largest Latino city in the country.
I have yet to visit Chicago.
But you never hear about it.
No. You know, well, I hear how cold it is.
Yeah, but you never hear about, you know. So I've been a couple of times, but it's not this, you know, it's not like L.A. I think we have kind of this privilege in L.A. rather than Latinos. Or, you know, we're the center of everything, but there are Latinos everywhere now. And we have to, you know.
That's one thing I do enjoy visiting other states. It's like, ooh, where's like the little Latino community or corridor?
Yeah. Like right now I'm working in South Colton, and that has to be the oldest Mexican bar in Southern California. Left.
Where's South Colton?
It's South Colton. You know, San Bernardino, Fontana, Rialto.
Oh, okay.
And it's an old packing town. You know, people pack, you know, fruits, you know, or I guess probably oranges.
Mm.
And it's a little tiny, like, it looks like all these little shacks, right?
Okay.
And it's still there. And everybody claims, like, they're second, third, fourth generation. And they all speak English.
Wow.
Nobody goes there, nobody goes there, nobody leaves.
Very so insulated.
So it's a really, it's just like, wow, it's like an old school Latino neighborhood.
It's like a time bubble,
yeah,
dang.
Yeah, it's really interesting because you go there, it's like, wow, it's like, it looks like vacant lots and little houses, little shacks, but it's been really fascinating kind of hearing that story out there.
Interesting.
And then I was working in Las Vegas, New Mexico, between Taos and Santa Fe and Colorado. This town is 200 years old, 14,000 people. It's divided between the American half and the Hispano half by the little river. You know, because what happened was founded by the Spanish, 100 years later, you know, the Americans come and build the railroad town.
Of course.
The American town.
Yeah.
And it was two different cities, a township and a city. Two different school districts, 14,000 people.
Man.
That's why people, it's like Boyle Heights, probably a fifth of Boyle Heights or something.
Yeah.
You know, but people there are still talking about that, you know, it's still in the culture. And it was really cool. You walk around those old Hispano neighborhoods, they can use like 200-year-old neighborhoods, houses, people still live in. evolve, you know. So, but a really rich experience looking at that, you know, the landscape and how similar it is to East LA. Mm. So, in fact, I gave a presentation there of East LA.
Interesting.
You know, they were like, wow, it's crazy, you know. Or, you know.
Thought everybody in East LA had a lowrider.
Yeah. I'd be walking East LA, by stuff and stuff like that.
Box to the corner store.
But they still have the Zanahamada, they still have the ditches there. It's just a really, really cool, really cool place. I mean, you should go there. It's a really cool place.
Yeah.
Really good vibe there, really nice people. And, they want to... But when I present the speeches to them on East LA, they're like, "Wow, we didn't know that existed." You know, they never see it. They see the lowrider or Cheech and Chong, and they think that's East LA, right?
They see a movie,
but
yeah.
They never think about the built environment.
No,
the spatial and visual language.
For the longest, that was me in New York, just thinking about all the movies I saw, like Midnight Cowboy, Ninja Turtles, Ghostbusters.
With the actual place there.
Yeah, the Warriors. The Warriors.
Yeah, but so it was really fun. You know, it's really fun working through the neighborhood and just really enlightening people about what's happening in their landscape and just adding them to my collection. You know, there's the place in the town.
Yeah. So, all right. So you kind of talked about it a little bit, but really, like, talk to me about your Placeit workshops. Like, what are they?
Okay, the Placeit workshops, they kind of evolved from the gallery, but it's using objects as a way to get people to talk about urban planning.
Okay.
Or using the visual and spatial cues of a city as a tool, and not the abstract words, numbers, and maps.
Yeah, like I was saying before, where somebody prints out a poster board and you're putting stickers on it.
Yeah. And that's just way too limiting.
Okay.
And people have experiences, people have lives, people have bodies, and you want to share that body with the environment.
Yeah.
You want to understand what that looks like. So I've done over 1,000 workshops.
You're pretty consistent because I see what you're doing on Facebook because you're pretty good about uploading where you are.
Yeah. It's all over the country, every demographic, every issue.
And like giving tours too. I saw some pictures. I mean, I was like, you know, like just looking through your profile, getting ready for the interview as I was writing my questions. And I was like, oh, look, you're out there in the mission, like giving some youth.
A tour. Yeah, because, I think, what's interesting about Latino urbanism is that, you know, we build a spatial visual landscape.
Mm-hmm.
We see it, we smell it, we live it every day. You know, we know it intimately, but we take it for granted and we don't talk about it
because it's our everyday environment.
But if you don't talk about it, you can't put a value on it.
That's
if
true.
You can't put a value on it, you can't defend it.
Mm.
You can't. This is what it is, right? So for me, it's like when I do my presentations, you know, of all these slides of picture images from the East Side. I have people telling the story. What's the quinceañera? What's the street vendor? What do you buy from there? You know, what's the fashion? What's the callejón? You know, what are these things? Telling the story about these things. And when the audience tells you the story, they put a value to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll come up to me afterward and say, I never knew that place mattered. Exactly, it matters.
Kind of helping folks realize, stepping out of the... You know, looking out from the outside in, stepping out.
Yeah, but putting value to it.
Yeah.
And then, because that's when you put the value to it, then that's when you can plan for it.
Hmm.
You know, it's like, yeah, because then it's like, you like strawberry, you like chocolate? Equal value.
But let's put them together.
Yeah. In the bulletin. Yeah. That's really tasty. But so it's helping. I'll do a lecture at MIT with Chicano students in school. I'll ask the class, how many of you have a front yard fence around your house? Half the class raises their hand. I'll ask them, well, why is it there? I don't know. My dad just built it one day. Well, why? You know, why did he build it? You know?
Did he want a lawn?
Do you want
a place for y'all to play in?
You know, but you have to take ownership of that space.
Yeah.
That's part of who you are. It's part of your identity. You know, and it's just... In fact, for me, I grew up in, you know, my other grandma lived on 2nd and... No, Martin Franco. Before Roosevelt expanded, and we had three houses, and in between the houses was like this piece of concrete, and that was our plaza. We'd go there every weekend and play there. And you had all these people there, and they had all the old timer, you know, Latina women there, and all the guys playing poker, and it was our space. And you know, and I inherited that landscape from my grandmother to understand the greater Latino
No, it's true.
You know, you just kind of came with it, right?
It's only when I get out of the neighborhood, sometimes, whether that's going to like the west side or to another state, where like, oh man, you really do take your neighborhood and like your living space for granted.
Yeah. But you have to be able to articulate it, what it is.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the problem, is that we don't articulate what that is, what it looks like, so people disappears.
Yeah. It goes underappreciated, undervalued, and then because it's undervalued, then it's not seen as a resource and a necessity. So it's like, yeah, let's get rid of that. Yeah, put a parking lot in there.
There's no story behind that. We don't need that, you know. But for me, it's like, you know, tell me the story, tell me what it is, tell me why it's valuable.
So where was the last workshop you did?
The last one was at Cal Poly Pomona, I think. They did one up in Berkeley.
Okay.
Then I did one at Occidental. Yeah, I do. Yeah, but for me, so what I do at the workshops is I did a really cool one in Santa Monica or Pico Boulevard, like in a zoning there.
Mm-hmm.
So we had everybody build a favorite child memory, and all the African American women there built doing hair with their elders.
Favorite
child memory, right?
Yeah.
So now the second part was how to redesign Pico Boulevard. So they built all the workshops and beauty supply stores.
Interesting.
Because you see that narrative from their childhood about the hair being played out in their adult world. Mm. Yeah, I need that beauty supply store. I need that workshop. You know, because that's where we come together and get our hair products, do our hair. And so it's putting value to these spaces.
Interesting.
And, you know, and for Latinos, you know, they tend to build their grandmother's yard. You know, kind of takes care of, you know, at some point they're always hanging out there.
Very like childhood memory attached to that. I mean, usually positive memories because you're having fun. There's
It's positive memory, it's fun memory. But that's the hidden narrative behind that landscape. So now they think, now when I do tours of East LA, all people, anywhere, all Grand Rapids or Brownsville, Texas, I'll tell them, whose front yard is that? And what is front yard? all the pots and plants are right, but putting a narrative to that landscape, that's where the culture gets translated, gets transferred over to the young ones.
Interesting. So, if anybody's interested in learning more about your workshops or participating, or even like inviting you to like do one, where can folks get a hold of you?
They could just my website, or place it, or they could look me up on Facebook.
James Rojas on Facebook.
Yeah.
I also, I don't think you keep these accounts as active as your Facebook, but you're on Instagram as James T. Rojas.
Yeah.
And then on Twitter as just his first and last name as James Rojas.
Yeah.
So you're not hard to get a hold of.
Yeah. Pretty out there, yeah.
Is there anything that's coming up that you want to like share with folks?
Oh yeah, in fact, we're doing a presentation on a Wednesday here at Libros, the Machi Plaza.
Libros, me bros.
Between 7 and 9, looking at the, you know, Latino urbanism and looking at, it's going to be called Live Well, Live Brown, Latino Resiliency.
Hmm.
Looking at the cultural practices that Latinos bring, you know, to the U.S. to make their culture resilient. You know,
so this would be Wednesday, December 19th.
December 19th, yeah.
7 to
9.
7 to 9 at Libros Mibros.
Yeah, and then on Wednesday, then on Saturday we're doing a walking tour of a neighborhood, you know, of Mariachi
Plaza. Saturday the 22nd.
Yeah.
Okay.
9 to 12 or 9 to 1.
To meet at Mariachi Plaza.
Yeah, 9 o'clock, and we walk around the neighborhood. We're gonna look at the plants, looking at indigenous plants.
Oh, that's right. You introduced me to Guatemoc.
Look at the plants, look at the landscape, and figuring out how that gets. These are 1,000-year-old traditions that we still tap into for well-being. So the whole idea is to really think about, you know, live well, live brown, live Latino resiliency, you know, to really kind of give us some cred, that we have some, you know, resiliency is not just this top-down thing, but it's kind of a cultural thing.
Yeah, cool, awesome. Well, if you happen to listen to this podcast early enough, hopefully you can make it. Like I said at the beginning, that this is one of the times where I was introduced to James, and his work was through one of his walking tours, which he unfortunately doesn't do now, just because there's not that many people like putting up like how do you say nacimiento
in English? Nativity scenes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of I will, because I live in a house, but it's a back house, right? Because my landlords live in the front area, but we have an in between space shared. I kind of sometimes want to have that front like lawn, you know, grass area, just so I can like mess with my neighbors. So because when I start thinking about nativity scenes and like, you know, people put out like baby Jesus, you have all these like animals, and like, you know, some folks do it more than others, and in other times of the year too, like Halloween or Christmas, you know, people put up their decorations. Growing up, I never really like cared for it, and even now I still don't, because I just really don't see a point to it. But now now for some reason, like, it's just this mischief in me to like do something with it, you know? Because everybody's like in the mood of like, oh, let me decorate my house and do something. I would do the same, but like just really like mess with people's minds. Like, I will set up a nativity scene with like maybe dinosaurs and stuff like that.
I mean there's no right or wrong here.
No, it's my house.
Do whatever you want. You know, you do it all.
Or like spell profanity with Christmas lights.
It's all good. I mean, but that's part of your.
That's me.
You know? And I think that's one of the key elements of Latin urbanism, that everybody has their own personality in their front yard.
Yeah.
You know, and we respect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, like, depending what I would put on, I think people would respect it.
Well, you know, and you can tell the people are your stuff, yeah.
I swear to you, I would probably write something like, you park like an asshole, or like, screw all of you, I hate all of you, like, tell your dog to stop barking at night.
Yeah. That's part of it. That's part of who you are. That's
but
part
I mean,
of
but in a genuine
but
sense.
But as long as you participate in the conversation.
Yeah, I want to have fun with it. I want you know, oh, you're setting up baby Jesus, and well, I'm gonna set baby Jesus up over here with dinosaurs and like robots.
Yeah.
And ninjas.
Yeah. I'm gonna set up an old baby Jesus.
Or maybe I'll like do some performance art and make you know all the pieces that would like normally be like plastic or, you know, fake, and have actual people do it.
Yeah, that's a better idea.
Just act something out.
Yeah, act the whole thing out.
I mean, now that I'm getting older, it's like I and having been to other communities and other cities, I really am more conscious of space, especially because my girlfriend is from New York.
Oh yeah.
And it completely like baffles my mind that she grew up in an apartment her entire life.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, me too. I've been like, New York's... Well, New York's... that's what separates New York from L.A. is that when you go to New York, you move to New York, you go there to become a New Yorker.
I don't. I go there to eat pizza.
Yeah. But you still have to hustle there. You still have to... You have very little...
No, that's... See, I think that's me being very lucky and fortunate that whenever I go to New York,
you don't have to work.
It's never for work.
It's
like I can take my time and like, oh, stop right here in the middle of like the sidewalk and look up at this like gothic church and like completely disrupt the flow of pedestrian traffic.
And that's true, but most New Yorkers are really like, people go there and become a New Yorker. In LA, you do whatever you want. Nobody cares.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I feel that energy though, especially on the subway.
That's
when I noticed that like New York is like horrible at like ADA compliance.
Oh yeah, it's horrible.
Like every once in a while, I find myself helping somebody out with like a stroller or something. Like, hey, can I help?
Or even
you?
Luggage.
Well, I don't know about luggage. If you can carry luggage, you're probably able-bodied enough to handle that. But you know, it's usually somebody with like a stroller. Like, hey, let me help you take it upstairs. Help you take it downstairs. Or I'm not running toward my train.
Yeah.
Or I'll do what I do here in LA, where I'm just like, all right, y'all are obviously in a hurry, so I'm just going to let everybody go in, and then I'll just like squeeze myself in, or I'll give up my seat and things like that.
Yeah.
So it's funny that it takes going to New York to bring out the...
LA in you.
The niceness in me,
LA in you. Understand your LA part.
Because even here in our public transportation, depending on what train you are and what time of day, there's usually plenty of space for everybody, you know, to like sit down or to, you know, not be breathing next up to somebody like in some creepy way.
Oh yeah, and you're truly too crowded.
Yeah, I was watching a video earlier of like two people fighting on the train because they were just so close together. But what's one of your favorite cities to visit?
I don't know. There's a lot of cities. I mean, all of them have like something special, you know, but I like walking around Latino neighborhoods.
Okay.
Like in Bronzeville.
No matter where it is, just experiencing it, how it is there.
Just kind of looking at the queue, looking at what people are doing, looking at a lot of creativity there. And
I've seen some of the pictures when you do that where, I think it was in Texas, there was like a bunch of horse heads on like a gate.
Oh, that's Compton.
Oh, that's Compton. That's Compton. Somehow I thought that was Texas.
Yeah. Well, it looks like Texas. Looking for stuff like that, you know, cause thinking somebody intentionally did that.
Yeah.
You know, what's the story behind it?
You know, you obviously like horses.
Yeah, what's the story behind it? And it's interesting. Sometimes you'll talk to the people that do that stuff, and they're so like low key people. Oh, I'm a gardener, and I just thought I'd do this.
Yeah, like I grew up with horses.
So it's really to kind of investigate these landscapes and kind of showing people what the patterns here.
Interesting. All right. Well, is there anything else you want to let folks know about that you got coming up? If you want to learn more about James, you can look him up on Facebook. I think he'll be more than happy to add you as a friend. And then your website is placeit.org.
.org.
So placeit.org. There you can find all the info about his workshops, you know, where he's going to be at, and if you want to invite him to come do one for you as well.
Yeah. I also have another website called the Enacted Environment.
The Enactive?
Enacted.
Enacted Environment.
That's based on my research. So that's where I do all my Latino photos at.
All right. So if you're like more policy wonk, that's where like the bread and butter is.
Well, more of the pictures, more of the Latino stuff.
Okay, cool. Yeah. All right. Let me write this down so I can put this in the description of the podcast. So Enacted
Environment.
Environment. Com or org?
I think it's com.
Okay, I'll look it up either way. And place it. .org. And I'll have this up in the description of the podcast. And if you are listening to this podcast, thank you. If you would be so kind, give it 5 stars on iTunes. So far, I'm the only one that's done that. Well, actually, like 6 people. So I would say 5 because of mine. And then I'm the only one that has like a comment on it.
I'll put a comment on it.
But thanks again, James. It was great catching up with you. I know you're always like about town and busy. So I really appreciate, you know, giving me the time and coming in here to talk shop.
No, that's fine. It's a great pleasure.
Awesome. All right. Let's put this back on. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
This has been Orale Bo Heights, and I'll see you in 2019.
Just put it in my pad. I remember it was December. Thought it was the best day of my life. I lost my mind. Should have had a good time. That long day was filled with